Hey, this is LOA Today, the Law of Attraction show. Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and Joel Elston here. It is Thursday, December the 8th, 2016. And as we promised last week, we are this week going to start a sort of an odyssey, a journey for the next few episodes, maybe quite a few episodes, because there are a few chapters in this book. We're going to explore the book Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And Joel, last week when we decided we were going to do this, we kind of skipped through the first chapter, although if you get the book and decide to read it yourself, you should not skip the first chapter. You should actually read it. It's got some good stories. It'll get you kind of into the groove and so forth. But it doesn't actually get into the how you do it stuff, which is why we're starting with number two. And Joel, you were mentioning before we even got started here, it's so easy to get these things because it's public domain now.
Absolutely. If you do a quick search, you can, you know, I right before we went on the air today, I just did a Google search of, you know, Think and Grow Rich PDF free. And there's like 15 links on the first page. So it's just is free multiple places. And it really is sort of the starting point for the law of attraction of every law of attraction guru that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I think everybody can agree who's involved in the law of attraction. They all learned it here first. Maybe Rhonda Byrne might disagree because she learned from Wallace Wattles first. But I would say that Napoleon Hill's impact is slightly larger than Wallace Wattles.
I agree with that. And you'll see as we go through this, and we'll sort of talk about it, and as we do every week, it probably will take a direction of its own. But you'll see the underlying piece. This took place many years ago. This is last century stuff, where early last century stuff, where this discovery was made. The term law of attraction did not even exist at this point, as you mentioned last week.
Right. Yeah, it didn't exist, and it hadn't even been considered. What would you call this thing? In fact, I think during the book, Hill at one or more points said something to the effect that I don't know what this thing is.
Right. Yeah, he alludes to the. You can see him stumbling around for sort of a name for it.
Trying to find words. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Because he discovered something, and I was actually explaining this to a client earlier this week. Imagine when someone when Sir Isaac Newton he didn't discover gravity. He defined gravity. It was already there, but his understanding of gravity. Before that happened, the word gravity did not exist as far as in the way we use it today. So when you discover something, it isn't named until you name it. And law of attraction eventually became it's such a comprehensive explanation of what's happening. But again, it's interesting to see there was no name attached to it back then.
Absolutely. So we're going to start off with chapter two, which is entitled Desire, the Starting Point of All Achievement, which is the first step toward riches. And this actually, the first few paragraphs are why you want to read chapter one, because chapter one, he tells a story about a man who made it his obsessive dream to work with Thomas A. Edison. The guy's name was Edwin Barnes, and the story goes that he basically had no money, he had no future, he had no idea what to do, except he knew one thing. He wanted to be an associate of the great Thomas Edison. And he didn't even have a way to get to New Jersey where Edison was. He couldn't afford the train ticket. But wow. He ended up riding, I can't remember what the colorful phrase is to describe it, but basically he stole a ride on a freight train. And that was the only way he could get there. And when he got there, Edison later described it as he saw this tramp standing in front of him, and the tramp was declaring that he was going to become his partner. And Edison kind of scratched his head, but he had seen this kind of thing before, and it was not out of the realm of possibility. So, you know, he gave him a menial job. And the guy, Edwin Barnes, did this menial job for about 5 years, didn't really get anywhere with his job about working with Edison, just he was working for him, but doing something that Edison really didn't care much about. And then finally, the day came when Edison's, what we would call it, a dictaphone. And I don't remember exactly what they had a special name for it. They originally called it the Edison dictaphone, and they called it something else later on, but it's a dictaphone. And the salespeople who worked for Edison really didn't believe it could be sold. What would you use it for? It just seemed they had never conceived of the idea of having executives dictating into a dictaphone so that the secretary could use it. That concept hadn't come along yet. Well, Barnes said, okay, here's my opportunity. He says, I can sell it. And Edison says, okay, give it a shot. So he goes out and he starts selling very, very successfully, to the point where Edison gave him a full contract, basically. You know, you get the entire United States. This is your territory. Go sell it. And Barnes ended up selling millions of dollars of these dictaphones. In fact, there was even a phrase that went along with it. The catchphrase, the motto, if you will, that went along with the product was invented by Edison and installed by Barnes. Now, these days, of course, we have no idea about that because we don't even use dictaphones anymore. We have iPhones with little recording softwares on them. But nevertheless, that was a big thing back in that day. And you mentioned, Joel, that this all kind of started at the turn of the 20th century, which is true. The thing that's really interesting to me is that the book actually didn't get published until the middle of the Great Depression.
Yes.
And that, yes, it was significant because you've alluded to this a couple times in the past. There are a lot of people who became millionaires starting from nothing during the Great Depression. And I think that it's very safe to say that Hill was a major reason why.
I completely agree. And this concept that you're talking about, of that we have discussed many times, the perspective of the Depression, when you were in a depression, it applies in multiple definitions there, but we're talking about a financial depression.
That's right.
When you're in a financial depression and you're accepting that, that's what you are in. And when you immediately change your perspective, you realize you see the opportunities. And in fact, there are, you know, economics professors that will say during downtimes there are more opportunities to become very wealthy. I mean, when you can go buy or take over property for literally pennies on the dollar, when you can, there's opportunity during depression or economic downturns. That I have a friend that to this day, he waits for horrible crashes in the market and then he jumps in. He has a lot of money. And he started doing this when the, it was it 2007, 2008, the banking crisis?
Right.
Wells Fargo at one point, you know, not Wells Fargo, Wachovia was a bank that basically went out of business during that.
Right.
And when it slid down, he bought Wachovia shares. He bought 100,000 Wachovia shares for 93 cents a share. The day that it crashed.
And I'm sure everybody who's heard that he bought it thought he was crazy.
Right. But his logic was that Wachovia cannot go out of business. It was a huge bank in the Southeast. It can't. And something's going to happen. Ended up the government brokered a deal with Wells Fargo where they took it over and at four, I think it was $4.50 a share. So in a matter of 2 weeks, he went from 93 cents a share to $4.50 a share. And he does that. He finds the most opportunity in the downturns in the market.
Not a bad return. I mean, he basically turned $100,000 into $500,000.
Right. In a few weeks. And step back, and then he does it again when these things go down, and he'll wait patiently for a long time, knowing there's going to be a bubble burst again. And he did it during the internet. He did it during, you know, one of his big things was when Priceline.com was again trading for pennies a share. He bought I think 100,000 shares of Priceline.com for pennies. And last I saw was $123 a share or something. So it really is an opportunity for him, and he knows that. So this is one of the things I think that Napoleon Hill helped a lot of people with during the Depression, where it is a mindset. And so when we have good times, I know people that think, well, there's less opportunity in good times. But again, it's all about a perspective. And this gentleman that we're talking about, Mr. Barnes, that was demanding or insisting on working with Mr. Edison, he worked, as you said, sort of a meaningless job for 5 years. Well, there's a line in the book, and I'm reading it directly right now. It says, to everyone except himself, he appeared only another cog in the Edison business wheel. But in his own mind, he was the partner of Edison every minute of the time from the very first day he worked there. Now, his perspective was him and Edison were a team. From Edison or anyone else's perspective, he was a guy just doing random stuff with the company. Ended up being, as you said, that main, his perspective landed him that incredible opportunity, which brought millions of dollars, and going back into the time, probably the equivalent of $1 billion now. And it's just such an amazing story that he had this burning desire. He was just, he knew that was the course he wanted to take. He knew that he was going to be successful this way. He believed it. He envisioned it. There was zero doubt. He was willing to give 5 years of his life to what everyone else thought was a meaningless pursuit. And in the end, it turned out to be, you know, what made him a very wealthy man as well.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, I don't want to go on a detour too far here, but you mentioned your associate who buys low and sells high during downtimes, which is a wonderful story. I do want to caution people about that because it's actually the desire that's more important than the activity. And the activity is one that you really, really have to be good at. Because the simple fact is, most stuff that goes down for a good reason and doesn't come back. So Absolutely. It's not like you should go out there. I mean, the philosophy is called buying when blood is running in the streets, which is a very gory way of describing it. But it does kind of illustrate what's going on. But you don't do that unless you are 100% certain that it's going to turn around. He was 100% certain because he knew that the Federal Reserve was never, ever going to let Wachovia go completely under with all the assets being destroyed. They weren't going to do that. That was his rationale for it. But if he had done the same thing with, say, I don't know, I'll just make it up, you know, some product, some widget that was, you know, being made and the company had basically crashed, he probably would have been crazy to do the same kind of investment because the widget would not come back. It's not like all of a sudden demand's going to explode out of nowhere.
That's a great point. And I do, I'm, especially me with my history and having a gambling addiction, I want to be very clear that speculative stuff like that, we're not giving any financial advice here or suggesting anybody. You have to be trained in the market, and you also have to be prepared to not care if it doesn't work.
Right.
This gentleman is in a position to be there where at the end of the day, he didn't care. He was excited about it. He believed in it, but he wasn't going to miss a meal. When you put everything out there, and I know, again, from my own experience, when you're investing or gambling, even from a perspective of fear, like this is my only shot to do it, that creates the opposite effect, and you will lose all of your money.
So exactly.
This is more about an attitude, absolutely, or a belief system. But during down times, that bigger picture, there are more opportunities because so many people are on the negative side of the law of attraction and belief that it allows opportunity for those of us that are on the positive side that most people aren't seeing.
That's right. Exactly right. By the way, there's an old joke that you may have heard. It's about how to make a fortune in the winemaking business. Have you heard that one?
I have, and I forget exactly how it goes.
Oh, it's very simple. If you ever want to make a small fortune in winemaking, it's very simple. Start with a large fortune.
Exactly. I heard a little differently. Said if you want to make $1 million in the wine business, start with $5 million.
Yeah, right.
And it's such a it's so true with that whole concept. So I want our audience to understand the law of attraction. We're not giving you specific advice on how to do things.
That's right.
Correctly. What we're talking about is an attitude. And during a depression, the worst economic downturn in the history of our country, it was so bad. And of course, it was a global depression.
It was.
Because of our economy was bringing everything down. There were people that became wildly successful.
Yeah.
And I, as you said, I directly equate that knowledge for those few that really believed in what Napoleon Hill was talking about and applied that technique. And that's the hope that I'm trying to get across to everyone,
right,
is that we're out there. That attitude is what we're talking about. It's very exciting.
And that's what Hill was talking about, because this chapter is entitled Desire. And
right,
in fact, the reason we told the Barnes story is that he carries on the Barnes story in the beginning of this chapter, saying that when Barnes climbed down from the train 30 years before this book was published, he may have looked like a tramp, but his thoughts, in Hill's words, were those of a king.
Right.
And the reason for that was, this is something that Hill puts in full capital letters, it's because he had a consuming obsession of his life, a burning desire. That's why this chapter is called Desire. It's the desire that made the difference. Because he didn't get off that train knowing how he was going to become a partner of Edison. All he knew was to walk up to Edison and say, hey, I'm going to be your partner someday. But he had no idea how to accomplish it. The only thing he knew is that he was bound and determined somehow, if it took 20 years, somehow he was going to do it.
Well, and one of the things that I have experienced personally in my own life, and I share the pretty much openly everything that's happened, good, bad, and indifferent. And when I lost my job at the treatment center that I was working at, I was not prepared. I really thought I was going to be there for a long, long time, I could, even though a side of me felt it was going the opposite direction of where I believe law
of
attraction
course.
Stuff.
Yeah, that would be your first reaction, I would think.
Right, right. And so, and I could see now where I was sort of like, okay. And I halfway wanted to do my own practice for a long time. I thought I could make it. I was pretty confident I could make it. However, I was making a very good salary, and I had a respected position, and it wasn't a lot of effort that I was putting in at that point. It was, in fact, I probably was getting a little bored with it, and I see all that now. But once I lost that job, and I had no option but to do my private practice and make it successful, that is when I applied all that energy and quickly, in a very short period of time, was making more money than I made. And that's the piece. I make more money than I would have made if I'd stayed with the company that I was at.
And it would have been much more comfortable to stay at that company.
Much more comfortable. And I wasn't, side of me is like, well, why didn't I leave before that? Because it wasn't, I wasn't ready to cut off all of that comfort and that ease. It's just human nature. Most people I know that have become wildly successful were propelled into their success by a loss of a job or being forced into something else. Most entrepreneurs do that. There's a paragraph that says, every person who wins at any undertaking must be willing to burn his ships and cut off all sources of retreat. Only by doing so can one be sure of maintaining the state of mind known as a burning desire to win.
Mm-hmm.
Essential to success. And that's what happened to me is now I wasn't voluntarily placed into a position of no retreat, but there was no other option for me. I mean, the idea that I had to go make this be successful, I never doubted it was going to be successful. I pretended in my mind I was viewing it as successful. And within 2 weeks, I did take a couple of weeks off, but of 2 weeks of me starting my endeavor, I was making pretty good money. Within a month and a half of me, I was making more. So it happens. And I had no, but it wasn't going to happen if I were going to halfway attempt it. If I, I thought about, well, I'll maintain a part-time job at this company and then I'll do my private practice on the side till I build it up. That wouldn't have worked because I wasn't willing to go all in on that concept. And that's what really matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that all in is huge. I think we could also probably argue that even though it was forced on you, probably some way you attracted it just because of the stuff that you were focusing on in your work and in your life. And you had this desire to do this anyway. You already said that you had the desires kind of in the back of your mind. Well, you apparently spent a lot of time on it, a lot more than you realized, because you weren't making it happen. So the universe did.
Well, and Walt, that piece is something that I'm so glad you brought up, because I found myself, and you know me to be a very upbeat, positive person. I'm that way all the time. But it was one of the few times in my life, the last couple of months I was there, I dreaded going to work. I hated the drive into work. I would pull in the parking lot and go, oh, you know, it just feels so drained.
Isn't that interesting? It's interesting for two reasons. First of all, and this is perfectly understandable, when you told the story the first time, you really left that part out. And I know you didn't do it maliciously or anything, but I would be willing to bet that it just didn't even occur to you that that was a piece of it until I brought it up.
Exactly, and I manifested the change. I brought it about because my perspective had changed. I started viewing the company as different, and again, without bashing anyone, it had become a much more negative environment. In fact, if I had only one negative piece of my life, it was some of the interactions that was taking place at the job. So where I don't have the negative in my personal home life or my friends, I don't do chaotic relationships. I don't do dramatic relationships. I don't allow people in my life that are negative. But yet work had, at that point, it had some very negative thought processes taking place in other people. So I was not liking some of the energy. Now, I'm always very clear, I loved working with my clients. I love the face-to-face interaction. I love the daily. That's the piece that sort of kept me. And I love working with my staff. But it was quickly becoming clear to me that the management side of it, and I was a director, was sort of going a different direction than my vision, and that's where that clash was coming. So I certainly see where I totally brought it about. I didn't realize it at the time.
We almost never do.
right. But once I saw it, and we all have that perfect 20/20 vision through a rearview mirror. Well, I clearly see that now. But I find it interesting, and I've talked about this before, and I mentioned it in my book that I did not, when I lost the job on a, I knew it happened over the course of a weekend with a few conversations with the owner, and I was pretty confident on that Saturday that I was not going to be showing up for work on Monday. Mm-hmm. However, well, there was never a moment of fear or doubt. It just felt natural. That was different than other things in my life.
What do you think made it different?
I don't know. I attribute it. Here's what my hypothesis is.
Okay.
I had been through so much with whatever I'd been through, things had worked out always for the best. And I was and I will say, again, people roll their eyes when I say this, I was in a very good financial position, so I had no stress in that area. It was, if I would have gone 2 years without collecting a penny, I had enough money to not change my lifestyle. Mm. So that is a huge factor.
It is, and it's one that we don't want to overlook, because not that we're saying that you can't get there unless you have a nice big cushion. We're not saying that at all. It just makes it a whole lot easier.
It does. So I will say I had this huge safety net underneath me that if I wanted to take 2 years off and travel around the country, I could have done that. I had no desire to do that, but it was something that at least it gave me that cushion. So let me be clear, I had that cushion. But there was also another side of me that knew I have seen what I define as miracles or certain, you know, the law of attraction totally working on my behalf. So I never doubted it. And the synchronistic part of this was, as you know, and many of our audience members know, my retreat place is a bench in Florida with a lot of history behind that.
And a book.
Yes, the name of my book. I already had a plane flight scheduled to head down to the bench the following Friday, down to that area the following Friday. So I just viewed that as the universe telling me, you got this, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
It was just sort of fun. I took a month off from work, which I hadn't, it's been years since, I mean, I left the previous company that I was at for 10 years and then came up here. So it had been like 16 or 17 years before I had more than 2 days off. So, and that's my own choosing. It isn't that I wasn't allowed vacation. It's just I'm the kind of person that just goes and goes. And I took a month off and really enjoyed it. And it was going to take longer off, but the demand of people, the idea that, where are you at? Can I see you? When are you going to start? And in the middle of all this process, my dear friend and mentor, Dr. Sherman Master, found out that I had left the company, And he had a space in his office building waiting for me, not that that was planned ahead of time, that I immediately was able to rent an office with his group of professionals. And it seemed like it was all planned, Walt. It really was. It just fell into place. And I was just amazed by it. And it took very little effort to me to do it.
Well, obviously it was planned.
Yeah,
you it planned was, it. You just didn't realize you planned all of it, but still.
Right. Napoleon Hill goes into great detail in this book. He literally takes out, the method of desire for riches can be transmitted into its financial equivalent, consists of six definite practical steps. Here's six practical steps that he literally talks about and says, the first step, fix in your mind the exact amount of money you desire. It's not sufficient to merely say, I want plenty of money. Be definite as the amount. There's a psychological reason for the definiteness. I'm not going to be able to say that word, which will be described in the subsequent chapter. But there's a reason behind it. But just for the sake of discussion, the exact amount of money, that's something that, for a long time, when you think, I need to increase my money, I need to find more money, there needs to be more money. Well, if that's what you're attracting, oh, there's a penny, I stepped on a penny today. Well, you attracted more money.
That's right.
You need a specific goal. And he's very clear. There's other people that will argue against that. I know one of my heroes, Mike Dooley, sort of has a different view over that. Mm-hmm. But we're discussing Napoleon Hill's book, and he believes that an exact amount of money in your mind, and it doesn't need to be, well, I want $10 million. It has to be a believable sum. At the same time, if you really believe it, you can get there. There's no reason it can't be any number, but just a general crazy sounding number doesn't work
either. Yeah, well, I think that's the point here. It isn't just that you have a desire. A burning desire is a desire that is 100% mixed with belief. You have absolutely no doubt, total belief that the thing you desire is going to occur. And that's really right. What sets it. I think I agree with Mike, and I agree with Napoleon. I mean, Napoleon is right that you want to have a definite amount, assuming that helps your belief factor.
Exactly.
And Mike is right that you don't have to have an exact amount if that matches your belief factor.
That's the key. That understanding, that's how this thing works. In fact, the second step here sort of gets into that. Determine exactly what you intend to give in return for the money you desire. There's no such thing as something for nothing. So his process, this is what I call the law of action. Determine exactly what you intend to give. Are you willing to give? What are you willing to do?
Yeah.
And I will do whatever is necessary to when I started my practice. It isn't like I said, okay, I will work from the hours of 10 a.m. till 1 p.m. And I will only work Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and I will only see this. It was like, when do you need to meet? Sunday at 9 o'clock at night? I will be there. Mm-hmm. I became willing to build my practice. I remember when my dad was building his insurance business many, many years ago, he was telling me early that he would meet people at all hours of the day or night. There were people that worked on shifts at a local factory, and he would meet people in the evenings. He would meet people on Sundays. He would meet people whenever they needed to meet on their terms. And when you're willing to go in and do this for yourself, that's the difference between being the entrepreneur spirit. What are you willing to do? Well, it's pretty much I'm willing to do everything if I really want it.
And really this whole idea that there's no such thing as something for nothing in life is it's really nothing more than an expression of Napoleon Hill's and the 500 people he interviewed. The vast majority of them all shared this one belief in common. You don't give something for nothing. You have to put something out there. You have to take a lot of action. And therefore, they were right because they believed that. They could just as easily, I'm not saying just as easily, but they could just as believably, shall we put it that way, have said, well, you can attract stuff without giving up hardly anything. You can be willing to give up a pin and get $1 billion. But the key part of that is you have to believe it. If you can't believe it, then it's not going to work for you.
Well,
and in fact, he includes a poem much later on in this chapter which is from a poet that he doesn't identify. I wish he told us who the poet was, because I have no idea who wrote this, but it's a good poem. And it says, quote, "I bargained with life for a penny, and life would pay me no more. However, I begged at evening when I counted my scanty store. For life is a just employer. He gives you what you ask. But once you have set the wages, why, you must bear the task. I worked for a menial's hire, only to learn dismayed that any wage I had asked of life, life would have willingly paid."
Right. Well, exactly. And you know, when he talks about here's the concept. Here's what I spend as much time with my clients on the law of action as I do the law of attraction. And the reason I do is we are conditioned to believe action has to take place. It isn't impossible to attract something for nothing. However, we have a belief system that you can't, so therefore your actions have to match. If you say, I want to be wildly successful, but I'm going to sit in my chair and watch The Price is Right every day and wait for those things to happen, unless you really believe deep down that's going to happen, it has no shot.
And most of the time when we're in that place, we're asking for that, it's because we don't have it. We don't have the belief. We don't have the money. We've been dealing with lack for the longest time. So we're basically saying, I'm ready to completely shift my mind around 100% and believe that the exact opposite of what I believed in for the last 10 years is now my true belief system. Well, God bless you if you can do that. I don't know anybody else who can.
Well, and that's the thing. I don't know anyone that can do that. Now, as you become wildly successful, your belief system is the money flows, and then it becomes autopilot. But especially getting this started, it's a very important task that your actions have to match what your belief is, because if you don't take that action, it isn't the universe can't provide. It won't. It's not believing what you're saying.
Yes.
You're not believing what you're thinking. And so that's a very important key. So not to confuse everybody, but the idea of action is what's necessary, and only because it supports the belief system.
That's
right. So that's what that second step is. And the third step, he says, establish a definite date when you intend to possess the money you desire. That concept that it's coming, it's down the corner, is great. It's the beginning process, but when are you going to actually have it? When are you going to really believe it? Here's my take on that, and I've talked to other people that have a disagreeing view of this, but my take is it's exactly like the previous step.
Right.
I have to believe it's doable. If I say, I want to attract $1 million tomorrow, and I'm not, and I can't be being an impulsive gambler. I can't play the lottery, so I'm taking away any possibility of that. So, it is very unlikely that I can attract $1 million tomorrow because I don't really believe it can be done.
Yeah, I mean, just because we talk about this stuff all the time doesn't mean we are perfect at it, and you would have to be pretty much perfect in order to do that.
Yes. So the idea that I can say, well, but I want to be able to save $150,000 this year over the course of the year, and that's going to be what I save, and I'm going to do that with X, Y, and Z. That's a plausible thing for me to believe.
Yeah, that becomes much easier to believe. Now, all of a sudden, it sounds like it's in the realm of possibility, and you could actually get there even if you didn't believe in the law of attraction.
Right, and that's what I do. I have I've shared this story, it's been probably 6 months ago, but I had a young man come to me, and he was moderately successful. He worked for Xfinity and or Comcast or whatever their name is today, and they had
one of your favorite companies in the world, I might add.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that.
thank you for that negative reminder. But he was making probably about $60,000 a year at the time, and he was sort of the middle of the road guy, the lower end possibly of the people in his position. And so he said, I don't know what I'm doing. I want to make more money. I'm looking to change jobs. I said, what are you after? More money? I said, well, what's the highest paid person in your position at your company? He said, probably about $130,000 a year. I said, so if you want more money, you are in a job that some people are doing that. So why aren't you doing it? He said, I haven't been able to figure it out. I said, well, you don't believe that you can go from 60 to 130 in 1 year. You know, I wouldn't be able to do that. I said, but what if you were to add an extra sale a day? let's do some math. And so we figured out what an extra sale a day would be. It would work out taking him from about 60 to about 72. So if you could do that, then what would two extra sales be? And so we walked through the whole process. He quickly went from 60 to making an average of about 75 a year. And then once he believed in the 75, this is a process over about 9 months, he then started making enough to make about 100 a year. And once he bought that, now he's one of the highest paid people at that position.
Isn't it interesting how it accelerates like that?
It does. But he had to go through the process of believing it. And then the idea that he wouldn't have been able to jump to that. And all we did was we examined his day, and it turned out the way his job worked, he had about 3 hours in the middle of the day of pretty much downtime. So but he had these territories he could cover. So what if you went and knocked on, 10 doors extra a day, using the ratio of people that will agree to and all this? And we worked it out where he would just make 10 extra calls a day, which isn't that much, but he would do it by himself. He was really the leader of a crew, but he started doing private, his own personal sales to boost it. And it really became sort of what he was looking forward to today. But by adding 10 stops a day, he got himself up to that $125,000, $130,000 range by using the time that was already there. But more important, it wasn't the act of all that. It was his belief that that could take place.
Yes. And that's really the cool part right there, because one thing that we tend to get locked into, I think, when we're trying this kind of stuff for the first time, is we get a little bit fearful. We hear that poem about, don't settle for a penny when you can ask for a pound. And so we become fearful. Geez, am I asking too little? Am I asking too little? Well, maybe, but it's not like you're locked into that for the rest of eternity. The good news is you can go for that jump from 60,000 to 72,000 that you believe you really can do. And because you can believe it, you can desire it in a burning way so that you actually take the steps to make it happen. Well, right. Once you get to 72, guess what? You get to do it all over again. You can go to the next level. And there's no limit to how many levels you can go to. I mean, really, you mentioned that the highest paid person in that company made $130,000. And it would be very easy to come to the conclusion that that was the ceiling. But it actually isn't the ceiling.
No. There isn't. In fact, that becomes the next step.
That's right.
And that was the third, a definite date when you intend to possess the money you desire. So the definite date has to be congruent with your belief system of it happening.
Exactly.
That's very important.
Yes.
And then, just like we talked about, the fourth step is create a plan for carrying out your desire. And begin it at once, whether you're ready or not, to put this plan in action. You begin it immediately. We set it with using this gentleman's example. We set time aside where he's going to make 10 extra calls a day, 5 days a week. The next day, he began that process. He did it immediately. The next open window of time, he began it. He didn't like it. It was uncomfortable because he had really... He didn't realize it, but all he was doing during that 3 hours was just sort of searching the internet, looking at, silliness on Facebook and wasting time. But he thought it was productive time, but when he examined it, it wasn't. So he filled that void and took action. And so he had immediate results. That first day of those 10 extra calls, he had two extra sales, mm-hmm. which it was reinforcing. So by creating a definite plan and carrying it out, instead of mentally defeating yourself over and over, I'm going to do this next Thursday, I'm going to do this 2 weeks from now. How many times do I hear people, especially this time of year, I can't wait to the new year and I'll start exercising?
Yeah.
Is that really? You're going to wait the new year, huh? So it's just to create a plan now. Forget what is stopping. Take that action now. Wherever you're stuck right now, that's what I want I just beg of our audience to grasp. The action to take now, this is immediate. Your attitude flip right now changes everything. Take action now. And this stuff happens pretty quickly.
And there's a very, very important phrase from my perspective in this fourth step, which is you take the action whether you are ready or not.
Yes.
That to me is really important. And I'll tell you why it's important to me, Joel. The fourth step says create a definite plan for carrying out your desire and do it whether you're ready or not. Historically, my tendency has always been to make a highly detailed plan that covers every possible contingency.
Yes.
And what this step was trying to tell me was, is don't get so wrapped up in trying to cover all the contingencies. You don't know what all the contingencies are. You don't know all the things are that can go wrong.
Exactly.
I've actually been dealing with this lately, very lately, trying to get myself with some success to start taking action when I'm not 100% ready, when I don't have a complete plan. I have a plan. I have some, and in many cases, the plan is no more than I have a few steps I can take. I don't even know where the darn thing is going.
Well, and one of the things, I have behavioral strengths and behavioral weaknesses that I've dealt with in my life. One of my strengths that I've always been very proud of, I am very much a let's jump in this thing and let's get going. And let's deal with things. When my dad and I were in business together, and it didn't last very long, but when we were in business together, my dad is a super detailed person. When he is worried about before the doors open that we have the right paper clips in the right spot. I mean, that's how
I have to admit, I've never done that with paper clips. So I'm not quite that much, but
he's, and my point is, let's open the doors and whatever void we have, we'll fill it as we go, because instead of trying to anticipate everything, you're over preparing, and the direction of what people are looking for here, you're not going to prepare it the right way. You're not leaving the possibility of what's out there. Just see where it goes and start. And I often will use the statement with people, yes, we're going to begin this journey. I don't know how we'll get there. So instead of all this period of time of thinking about all this stuff, I have a young man. He was a Division I football player, college football player, great young man, and he had some issues at school, and he got kicked out of the program, and he made some great strides in his life, and he wanted to make a return to football. This has been after being off for a while, and the first thing I said, step one, we got to get back in the gym. You got to start eating right. So we started that process. And he wanted to plot and plan, okay, we're going to contact this school on this date and see if they're interested. I said, just do this part first. What we did was we contacted his former high school coach, who really liked this guy. Asked him, just put the feelers out there, see who's out there. We got the word of mouth. Randomly, a college he never even discussed called him and said, we're extremely interested. We can help you in these areas. We have some scholarships available. We have this, that, and the other. He said, I spent all that energy trying to figure it all out. And he said, the place that I wanted to be was never on my radar.
Just amazing how that happens. The other thing, too, is if you listen to professional planners, I mean, you know there are lots of them out there, people who will teach you how to do your business plan or how important it is to do a business plan. I know of one guy who's a business coach, and he basically ranks on people who don't do business plans. But even these people will tell you, you don't put a plan together and then forget about the plan once you put it together. You actually have to change it a month later. Yeah. And then 2 months later, and then 4 months later, you have to keep reviewing it and changing it. And when I first heard that, it was dissonant in my head, because on the one hand, I was supposed to figure all this out ahead of time, but on the other hand, it was all going to change later on. Well, why am I figuring all this out in my head in the beginning? I don't understand. I don't get this.
Well, I have a friend down in Florida that was in the insurance business as well many years ago, and he wanted to open up his own agency. So He had a direction he wanted to go. He really loved working with life, health, and disability insurance.
Okay,
and that sort of was his thing. So he opened that up, but he also had other access. He's a fully licensed agent. So one day, this guy comes in. He says, he was a long haul trucker. He said, I'm having trouble getting insurance. He said, can you help me? So the guy spent a lot of time researching it, and he said, He called this company that did it, and he set up a brokerage account with him and sold this guy trucker insurance. Well, the guy started saying, hey, this guy found me a really good company, and he did. He kept pounding the drum of, I'm a life, health, and disability coach, but yet he's selling all this trucker insurance. Mm-hmm. It's not matching. And finally, one day, he realized, wow, this is where I'm being led to. And this is many years ago. I'm sure the industry has changed a lot. But at one point, he was the largest salesperson for long-haul trucking in the Southeast United States.
Wow.
Huge. And was making a fortune selling long-haul trucking and never sold any. He laughed. He said, I think I've sold like 5 health and disability policies. And I've sold like 100,000 long-haul trucking policies. And it's just amazing that he could – he saw it, but everything he planned for was different. So business plans are great, and they're necessary to get banks and other people to buy into your concept. But the key to business plans is they're going to change. And the law of attraction is going to bring you stuff, but it's not always going to be that exact business plan how you have it there. It won't.
And that's why you take the action right now. That's why you don't wait to get all the ducks in a row.
Exactly. It will, you know, ready or not, put this plan in action. If you hear nothing else of today's show, which I love our show today, if you hear nothing else, whether you're ready or not, put your plan into action. It doesn't need to be a perfect plan. You don't need to listen to everybody telling you why it isn't going to work. You can't quit telling yourself, put it into action, and then the change on the run. One of the things that I think our president-elect did very well, he just ran his mouth in the beginning, and wherever it took him, it took him. It worked out well for him. He said something about one of our heroes in the said something about John McCain wasn't a hero. Well, he realized he messed up when he said that, but instead of defending it, he says, well, we're not doing enough for our veterans. So he made that a really important part of his. He just went with it. That ability to go with stuff like that is a great way to do things.
Yeah, he basically turned a really big lemon into lemonade.
Exactly. And the fifth step of this is similar to what we had talked about before. We were talking about writing a plan. It says, write out a clear, concise statement of the amount of money you intend to acquire. Name the time limit for its acquisition. State what you intend to give in return for the money. And describe clearly the plan through which you intend to accumulate it. Now, that sounds like a business plan to me.
It does. It sounds a business plan. The only thing that's missing is what we end up seeing in the sixth step. Because without the sixth step, the fifth step doesn't actually make much sense.
Right. That's why I'm going right to the sixth step. It says, read your written statement aloud twice daily, once just before retiring at night, once after rising in the morning. As you read, see and feel and believe yourself in the possession of the money.
And that's already it. That's it right there.
And that's what brings it about by buying into the concept. I work with addicts mostly, and I'm a recovering addict myself. So one of the things that I always tell people in the very beginning, let's fake it. Let's just pretend we're in recovery. Let's act. You have no idea how not to be an active addict. So let's just pretend you're in recovery. And let's believe it. Let's tell yourself you're in recovery twice a day, 3 times a day, 5 times a day. I have people tell you that all the time. You have to do that over and over and over and over. And you wake up one day and your belief, what you were faking, has come to fruition. You wake up and you're in recovery. It's an amazing feeling. It's the same thing here. You got to believe it. You got to buy into it and really feel like you've attained what you're seeking.
You know, there may be people listening in who are in need of that kind of help, in need of getting assistance. And I know that if I were in that position, the first thought that I would be asking myself is, okay, so what does it mean to say I'm in recovery? What exactly is that? What does that infer? That suggests something, but I don't know what that means. I don't know what it means to be in recovery because I'm not in recovery.
Sure. Well, and I think that anybody... There's two things I was told, because I asked the same question. Okay, number one, stop doing what you're doing to kill yourself, whether it's you're shooting heroin or gambling or drinking, whatever you're doing, stop. That's number one.
Which is big.
That's big. And really, it's sort of like, okay, we got that. So if you're going to act like it, let's stop, whether you really want to or not. Let's believe in that. And then behave like a productive citizen. Go out, go to work, do the right thing. If you do those two things in the beginning, if you know nothing else, the process of recovery can begin. And you believe in that. And along with that, I see people on a weekly basis. Sometimes I see some people 2 or 3 times a week. There's all types of meetings out there. But it's also continuing support to remind yourself or understand what recovery would be like. But it's the same thing in business or same thing with anything else. in the beginning, you don't know what it feels like to have the money. Pretend in the beginning. Look at it. Spend it mentally. But you don't know what it feels like. It's okay.
It's a funny thing because for years now, years and years, Joel, I mean, you and I have known each other now for, what, 4 years, something like that. And even going back before then, I have been learning and reading and studying and learning and reading and studying and hearing over and over and over again the same basic things. And they all amount to, you know, the kinds of things we're talking about here. But the most important piece of it is you got to act and believe as if it's true, even when you don't know that it's true.
Yes.
Which is confusing. Let's be perfectly blunt. That is confusing because it's not part of your natural behavior. So you have to start acting it. And that part is tough at first.
Yes. Well, I think that's the hard. We keep every week we find a new quote unquote hardest part. I think that is one of the harder parts of this concept of what you're believing, not what you're actually saying, but what you're believing is what you're putting out there. And I use the this is where it gets really deep for a lot of people, and I lose people at this at some time. But I want you to look at that, at whether you're negative or positive, that they each have their own wave or vibration, or if you picture some kind of, you know, cartoon where the waves, you can see the, you know, shock waves coming out. You're putting out waves all the time. You're putting out electricity, whatever you want to call it. You're putting it out there. And if it's a negative, defeated wave you're putting out, that's what you're tuning into. It's almost like a radio station. It's a radio station sending out a wave, and you're tuning into what you – and if it's a positive tune, you're going to tune in the positive. If it's a negative tune, you're going to tune in the negative. And the belief system is dictates what you want to do, what you're putting out there. That's what comes about. I often talk about when I get new people into my office – And they're coming in for counseling. I have some people, Walt, that will come in and they are vibrating on a very high level. That I know that is a weird word for a lot of people, but they're putting out a lot of positive energy. They're really excited. And I look up at the clock and an hour has gone by instantly. I'm like, wow. They leave and I'm like, well, I need to go work out. That boosted me up, excited. Then I have some clients that come in and I'm like, oh. And after about 5 minutes of hearing them whine, I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's been 5 minutes. It feels like 2 hours. My perspective is I'm
thinking. That's where I want to say to them, you want some cheese with that wine?
Exactly. So I try to raise that. That's what we do. But one of the things that you and I made a conscious effort about on the show several, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 months ago, is it the halfway point, at least in the show, everything needs to be, if it's not an entirely positive all the way up, we need to end on a positive. We need to be people with hope, have them instill hope. That's what I believe in. And when you end that way, then we're vibrating on that level. When somebody listens to an hour of our show, I want them to feel better than when they started listening. I want them to go, wow, I'm ready to go do this.
Oh, absolutely. Me too. And I was mentioning how it can seem unbelievable, and how it can, it seems like, how could that possibly happen? To make matters worse, you get steps like step 6 that says, read your written statement aloud twice a day, just before retiring, just after arising. And as you read, see and feel and believe yourself already in possession of the money. And when you're in that place where you just can't and possibly imagine how you can get yourself to feel that way about money or anything else that you are not currently familiar with, that seems ridiculous. And in fact, despite the fact, this is where I was alluding to earlier, despite the fact that I've been studying this for years, I knew for years that you were supposed to write down your goals. You were supposed to write down your affirmations, and you're supposed to do them on a daily basis, and you're supposed to read them through, and you're supposed to do it every day, and you're not supposed to stop. You're not supposed to do it for a week and give up. You aren't supposed to do it for a day and give up. You're supposed to do it for 30 days, 50 days, 60 days, 90 days, and I never did it. Well, just recently, Louise and I, my wife, have been doing exactly this. Interestingly enough, out of necessity, and weird things are happening. Very weird things. The circumstances that we're in are very difficult circumstances, very painful, very frightening circumstances, financially speaking. And I'll tell the full story one day on the show, but just leave it for the moment that we're in a bad place. And yet being in that bad place by doing this written part where we read the written part and actually modify it every single day. We don't just read it, Joel. We actually modify it. And we read it twice a day. that activity is producing weird results. Strange things are happening. Things that you can't really explain, because patterns that have been going on that were negative, we do this consistently, and all of a sudden something positive happens, and it's like, where the heck did that come from? I mean, I must have manifested it somehow, but I certainly don't remember doing it.
Right. Well, the you know, I hear often, you know, one of the things that I'm a believer in and have practiced is, not only do I write them down, I have a version of my vision board. I do it on the computer, but it's the same thing. I have every day I have 20 pictures of goals, and they're specific pictures, and you know, I don't share them with anybody. They're my goals, and it's just my thing. But I look at them every day and envisioning that, and I do that twice a day. Part mm-hmm. of my I write down the things that I want to. I see it, and I always find it interesting. The people, just like you're talking about, that when it comes to that piece, well, I'm not comfortable doing that, or I don't have the time to write something down, or that doesn't apply to me, or that doesn't work for me. Well, I accepted this stuff wholly when I started doing it, and I quit trying to figure out what worked for me and what doesn't work for me. This worked for these guys. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And you know, instead of that ego-driven thing where I'm going to do it differently, it's just do it. It's that simple, and don't overthink it. And the fact that you're seeing the results, writing these things down, reviewing them, and they say twice a day once you get up. I modify that. There's no reason, especially with you know, carrying around stuff on the you know, you look at everything on your phone. You can look at this 10 times a day.
Oh yeah,
see it, feel it, believe it, live it. And I manifested an entire treatment center by doing this years ago. I had a vision board of a treatment center that I brought about, and it was impossible to obtain, because what I wanted to do was financially impossible, but yet I brought it about.
I have a little sign that I made up that I have on the wall in front of the desk where I work. And it's not something I picked up from somebody else. I invented the phrase myself. But the sign says, I am source energy, and I make wonderful things happen by feeling good first. And yeah. I see that every once in a while. And very often I'll look at it and I'll say, yeah, right. And other times I'll look at it and I'll say, wow, that really was true today. I know exactly how that worked out. And some days I'll kind of look at it quizzically. But one thing that definitely happens is, by looking at it over and over and over again, it has become a major part of my psyche. It's gotten to the point now where I think about life this way. Even when I'm not attracting exactly the way I want to, this brings me back to, oh yeah, it's how I remember the various teachings. This is why you're not attracting that. You're obsessed with the lack of it. And so that's what's, you know, that you're attracting more lack. And it happens because you're source energy. And that's how the good things happen, assuming that you're feeling good first. Oh yeah, right. So that means I got to feel good first. I forgot I have to feel good first. Okay, that's what I got to do now. So when you talk about you do the written stuff and read the written stuff because that's what everybody else does. Actually, that thought process never worked for me. What worked for me was, and this is just me, seeing that statement so often about being source energy and about feeling good first, I realized, you know what? I don't know if this written thing works. I don't know if it actually does anything, but I do know that I am source energy, and I make wonderful things happen by feeling good first. So, I don't know. Let's try the written thing. Maybe it'll work.
Right.
Maybe it'll actually do something. Because I am the source energy. I'm the one who's doing it. So maybe that's exactly how you do it. I don't know.
And part of the thing that resistance piece is, we've talked about resistance before, and I know we're getting near the end of the show here, but the resistance piece, it lies in, you know, what are you willing to do? So whatever you're finding yourself reluctant to do or dismissing as something that doesn't work for you, have you really tried it? Mm. Have you really implemented it? And that's a big question to ask. The pieces to all that we talk about are available. Like I said, this is Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. It's available free all over the internet. And, you know, obviously each week we're halfway through the second chapter. We have plenty to do.
Oh, there's a lot to do. Yeah, it's going to be fun. And I'm looking forward already to do next week's show, because we'll pick up where we're we are right now. We'll get into chapter 3, and we want you to be a part of the journey, so please join us. By the way, don't forget, you can hear us on PRN, of course, where we're broadcasting this. You can also subscribe at the iTunes store to LOA Today. We're on YouTube, and you can also find us directly on our website at loatoday.net. So, Joel, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Walt, great to speak with you again, my friend.
We'll talk to you again next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.